In America, so many of us take the right to vote for granted, but as author Michael Waldman points out in his new book, The Fight to Vote, a battle royale has been raging across the country when it comes to voting since the nation was formed back in the 1700s. Fights over voter ID laws, which have been fought bitterly in Kansas and now Missouri, are only the latest iteration. Michael Waldman is also the author of The Second Amendment, a biography, and president of the Brennan Center for Justice. He joins us by phone from New York City. And Michael, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Now let's start at the beginning here, Michael. Our rights are enshrined in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, yet you start out in this book with the Declaration of Independence. Why?
Well, in part because the Constitution was largely silent on the issues of how we would run our democracy, what kind of rights voters had. But what proved especially important even then and then in the longer run throughout American history was the idea that Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, enshrined in that Declaration of Independence that government is legitimate only when it rests on, as he wrote, the consent of the governed. And it's been appealing to that notion over and over again that we Americans have fought to expand our democracy and to win the right to vote for more and more people. And it's often actually been by kind of going back to that basic civic religion that Jefferson set out. And of course, it was Jefferson, when he wrote that, was being attended to by a 14-year-old slave boy. So it was, wow. The contradictions were there from the start. But there was tremendous power, at the very least, in that ideal, and we're still trying to live up to it.
You know, you make the distinction early on that the demand of the colonists was for direct representation, but that didn't necessarily revolve around voting. Why weren't they more concerned back then about who would represent them over in England?
When they talked about that consent of the governed and when they talked about representation, they really meant before the Revolution, they wanted to be actually represented in Parliament, as opposed to what the British called virtual representation. And they weren't thinking very much about people being able to vote for their own representatives. At the time of the Revolution and in the early days of the country, only white men who owned property, a fixed amount of property, were eligible to vote, by and large. And that was a rule that went back to the Middle Ages. And that was sort of seen as a way to make sure that only truly independent people could have that voice. But even then, starting in the heat of revolution, it began to be controversial. Benjamin Franklin led a working man's revolt in Pennsylvania that won a much wider right to vote in that new state. And he, in fact, over and over again, when you look at the notes that were taken in secret by James Madison at the Constitutional Convention, whenever there was an idea of limiting the right to vote and putting that in the Constitution, Ben Franklin, bless him, said no. John Adams, obviously another revolutionary and a contemporary of theirs, he was very skeptical of giving people voting rights. And he said, if you take away the property requirement, next women will want the right to vote. And
wow.
lads, as he put it, will think their needs not attended to and they should be able to vote. And a man who hath not a farthing to his name will think he has an equal voice in government. And he said, there will be no end of it. And of course, Adams was right. There has been no end of it.
You know, from the earliest days, voting laws were the province of the individual colonies. How varied were the laws in each of those colonies? I mean, give us some examples of what some colonies required of those who could vote.
Well, you're right. And it's important to understand when we have these various fights today about voting. And voting rules, and they're varying now from state to state. Part of the reason, a big part of the reason, is that at the time of independence, the American colonies were independent countries when they broke off from Great Britain, and they each had their own rules. Now, they had these property requirements, but different people had different amounts of property in different states. You also had, farmers who were sort of out west. Land was cheaper, and a lot more of them could vote. But when you were closer to the Atlantic, then fewer people had that right. And in cities like Philadelphia, which was the second biggest port in the entire British Empire, there were lots and lots of people who were indentured servants and dock workers and slaves and others who couldn't vote. Plus, women couldn't vote, except in New Jersey. Believe it or not, women could vote at the beginning.
Huh.
That was taken away. That was taken away in 1807. There was a contested election, and men dressed up as women to vote on multiple occasions.
Wow! That,
now that's real voter fraud. And so the legislature, given that situation, what did they naturally do? They disenfranchised the actual women
wow.
rather than the men dressed as women. So in some places, Catholics couldn't vote. In other places, African-Americans could vote. In most places, of course, they couldn't. So there were somewhat minor variations. But the old rules were pretty much fixed. And then what happened was the ideas of the revolution and the heat of the revolution began to crack that old view, and you had places like Pennsylvania and Vermont and other places where now working men, in other words, people, men without property, were now allowed to vote. And that began to take on momentum in the early 1800s.
But still, what you're suggesting here is that the framers of the Constitution, they were fretting even back then about corruption. What do they think would happen?
Well, you're right. When you look at what they debated in the Constitutional Convention, they didn't really deal with the question of who could vote very much. They just kept it out of the document. But what James Madison and others were very worried about was exactly what you described, corruption, that state legislators in particular would pass laws to manipulate the voting rules to make it harder for their opponents to vote or win elections. And to do things like gerrymandering, what we would now call gerrymandering, rigging the lines. There's actually a provision in the Constitution that Madison insisted on called the Elections Clause. And it gives Congress the power to override state election laws. It's one of the only places in the whole Constitution that the federal government is explicitly given that authority. And it's because the framers, Madison and the others, worried that state officials would try to pass laws that would make it harder for their opponents to vote. And somebody like me, looking at a lot of the recent laws, would suggest that Madison was onto something.
We're talking about the longstanding battle for the right to vote in America. It dates back to the founding of this country back in the 1700s. We're visiting with author Michael Waldman, his latest book, The Fight to Vote. How long did it take and how many amendments to the Constitution were needed, Michael, before every citizen was guaranteed the right to vote?
Well, it took a long time, and as the original Constitution didn't make any reference to the right to vote, it was up to the states to decide. But then there were five separate constitutional amendments that talk about the right to vote. The first thing that happened was in the 1820s, white men without property, the white working class, in effect, who we talk about in elections now, won the right to vote, and they did it through a mass movement of creating the Democratic Party under Andrew Jackson. Then after the Civil War, the African-American slaves from across the South and throughout the country were given the right to vote, the former slaves, through the 14th, but then especially the 15th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And what a lot of folks don't know is that this amendment, which says you can't discriminate based on race, led to a flowering of democracy in many parts of the country where there was 90% voter turnout among black voters at that period, and hundreds of people elected to legislatures and Congress and even as governor and chosen as senator. But that was taken away by the Ku Klux Klan, by violence, and by very cynical political deals.
And that's why the turnout numbers dropped dramatically over the years then.
Almost down, literally, practically to nothing.
Wow!
And all across the South, and they were actually put in the Jim Crow constitutions, of the 1890s and turn of the 20th century. And what a lot of folks don't realize is that in the North, it wasn't as bad as in the South, but there was a real setback for democracy in the North as well, where the cities were now crowded with immigrants, and they weren't immigrants like we talk about from Mexico today. They were from Ireland and Italy and Europe. And a lot of the kind of old line blue blood people then were very worried about this, and they changed the voting rules to make it much harder for immigrants to vote. And they had literacy, English language tests and all other kinds of things. And then at the same time, you had something enter the picture, which we're very familiar with now, which is the role of big money. The sort of Gilded Age robber barons wound up financing the campaigns and diluting the power of the vote. And it was all a real setback in the late 1800s for American democracy. One thing that's worth noting, you know, from the framers forward, they didn't just think in terms of these formal rules of who could vote, but they really looked at all the ways in which the power of that representation could be diminished, whether it was gerrymandering or too much influence for property in the voting rules. And we make a mistake sometimes today if we think of these all as very separate issues. It all goes back to kind of what is a real democracy.
You know, one of the interesting points you make in this book is that this country is one of the few democracies in the world in which the onus of registration rests on the individual. What do other countries wind up doing, Michael?
Well, the way it works in other countries, whether it's Canada or England or Germany or really other democracies, is the government takes on the responsibility, and if you are a citizen, if you're eligible to vote, you're on the rolls from the time you're 18 or whatever forward. And in this country, we actually have some of the more ramshackle registration systems and cumbersome approaches that it's possible to have. And so right now in our country, we have about 50 million eligible voters who are not registered.
Huh.
There are also, by the way, plenty of mistaken names, dead people's names still on the rolls, all that kind of stuff, which leads to people being worried about people voting who shouldn't be voting.
And we do it this way. Why?
I would say more than anything else, inattention. And we don't take seriously the obligation to make this a meaningful part of what it means to be a citizen. The good news is there's progress here. This idea of automatic and universal and permanent registration has really taken hold. It would add 50 million people to the rolls, and it would cost less, and it would curb the potential for fraud if it were fully enacted. And you've now started to see in Oregon and California, they passed laws last year to move toward this. New Jersey, the legislature enacted something, although it was vetoed by Governor Chris Christie. I think it is a breakthrough. But as you know, these voting issues and in Kansas and Missouri are the epicenter for some of these fights. Voting issues right now that I think could be addressed in a nonpartisan or bipartisan way are instead the subject of tremendous controversy and I would argue manipulation for partisan gain.
Well, the concern out here, as you well know, Michael, is that there's voter fraud, and we want to nip that in the bud before it becomes too big of an issue. And I guess that leads to the question: how much voter fraud is there around this country right now?
Well, it's a great question, and the answer. I would say there's answers that would surprise conservatives and answers that would surprise liberals. The answer that might surprise conservatives is this. The type of voter fraud that these new laws purport to address is effectively in-person voter impersonation is vanishingly rare. By all accounts, it barely ever happens. And a lot of times there are allegations made, and then when you check into it later, this happened in St. Louis, for example. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch did this. When you check into it later, it turns out that it wasn't, in fact, an inappropriate voting. It was a typo or something like that.
I was going to say, a team of journalists at Arizona State just came out with a study saying that in-person voter fraud, which is what they looked at, in-person voter impersonation fraud, they looked at it going back since 2000. They found only 10 cases nationwide.
Right. And as a federal judge pointed out, you would need to be insane to commit in-person voter fraud because the penalties are so high and the benefit to you, the voter, you know, is pretty minimal to cast that one extra vote. And so you're actually, as a statistical matter, more likely to be killed by lightning than to commit in-person voter impersonation. So a lot of these remedies address something that's not a real problem.
You know, to what extent, that, Michael, did
but
the...
I do want to say we do have a history in our country of election fraud where politicians game the system whenever they can, and we always need to be very aware of and on guard for that. But these voter ID laws, for example, that are very restrictive and that require ID or proof of citizenship that lots of people just don't have, those kinds of laws don't address that broader election fraud.
You know, to what extent was what happened in Florida back in 2000 with the too close to call presidential election between George W. Bush and Al Gore, to what extent was that responsible for sort of instigating this rise in voter ID legislation and really looking this concern about the potential for fraud in our system?
Well, I say that at about four, it probably happened at about four in the morning that first night. First of all, people realized that turnout mattered, that we were in a very closely divided country in partisan terms, that you could now win an election not, as people had tended to think in the earlier period, you know, by running lots and lots of TV ads aimed at a handful of swing voters, that the key to winning might be turning out your vote or keeping the other side from voting.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw a tremendous upsurge in focus on this, in manipulation. There was a real focus on the part of Attorney General Thornburg. Voter fraud and looking for it and ultimately not finding it, and in fact having a scandal, Attorney General Ashcroft, you may remember there was a scandal later in the Bush presidency where a number of U.S. attorneys were fired,
right,
partly because they were not bringing prosecutions for fraud they couldn't find.
Including one here in Kansas City, yeah.
That's right. And so there was a great upsurge. And there was also a great deal of electoral and demographic change. The states that have passed these laws overwhelmingly have been states where there's been a big increase in minority voting and a minority participation.
Right.
And the way these laws are crafted, I'm actually for voter ID in the sense that I think people should have to prove who they are, and that makes sense. I'm just not for requiring ID that lots of people don't have.
Right.
And about 11% of eligible voters do not have a driver's license or a similar government photo ID. And about 7% of eligible voters don't have proof of citizenship, and it's kind of expensive to get.
Right.
And so these things tend to fall heavily on minority voters. And I think it's a mistake to go that way.
Well, Michael Waldman's new book, The Fight to Vote, interesting book, interesting conversation. Thanks for taking a few minutes, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.